IKEA is famous for their flat pack assembly at home furniture. I personally have put together lots of it over the years. And I know that it's stylish to complain about how difficult it is to put it together. But one of the things that I personally have always been impressed with is the quality of the assembly instructions that they provide. You can tell that they truly do carefully test those instructions and ensure that they are correct and easy to follow. There's one very important caveat to that. You must follow the instructions. Otherwise, you will struggle, you'll get frustrated, and perhaps you'll end up with a coffee table when you are supposed to be putting together a chair. Now, I've been told by people, I've had people complain to me about how difficult it is for them to put together IKEA furniture, and I ask, do you follow the instructions? And almost every single one of those people that have had trouble, they say, well, no, I don't need to follow the instructions. I can do it on my own. I can figure it out on my own. I go, oh, okay. Do you see any connection or correlation then with how difficult it is for you to put that furniture together and you not following the instructions? There's a sequence that needs to be followed so that everything goes together as intended. Following instructions matters. We're going to see that today in the stories that we look at. Last time, in our study through the book of 1 Samuel, we looked at the story of Jonathan and his armor bearer when they single-handedly, with the help of the Lord, set the whole Philistine army on the run. The two of them had quietly snuck off from the Israelite army encampment and went down into the ravine near the Philistine camp. And Jonathan told his armor bearer that they would let the Philistines see them. And if the Philistines told them to come up to them, they would take that as a sign from the Lord that he was going to give them victory over their enemy. So they stepped out in the open. Yoo-hoo! Oh, Philistines! And the Philistines saw them, and they told them to come up, and we'll teach you a lesson. Well, Jonathan, his armor bearer, they took that to be a sign from the Lord, and they immediately climbed up out of that ravine to fight the Philistines. And in short order, they had killed some 20 of the enemy. And then the Lord caused an earthquake, which set off a huge panic among the whole Philistine army so that they were starting to attack and kill themselves, one another. Well, the rest of Saul's army, they saw this developing commotion on the other side of the ravine in the Philistine camp. They realized that Jonathan and his armor bearer were those who were over there in that fight, so they then join in the fight. They inflicted heavy casualties on the Philistines, and they drove them out of Israelite territory. The Lord gave Israel a great victory that day, initiated by the courage and the faith of Jonathan and his armor bearer. Now, that story is recorded in the first half of 1 Samuel chapter 14. The second half of that same chapter, 1 Samuel 14, tells a story that took place within that larger story of Israel's victory over the Philistines. And it began this way, verse 24. It says, now the Israelites were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, cursed be anyone who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the troops tasted food. In Saul's zeal to destroy the Philistines that day, he put the entire army under a vow to not eat anything until Saul had avenged himself on his enemies, the Philistines. This vow was not something that the Lord had required of these men. It was simply Saul's own misguided attempt to ensure victory. In his mind, apparently, this would be a way to obtain God's favor and blessing on his army and their battle. All this vow really did, though, is make the fighting more difficult for his men. They had to fight without eating anything all day. It was a foolish vow. Well, then a little complication was discovered later that day, which made it worse. Jonathan, his son, had not been around when Saul made this vow about no one eating anything all day. You might remember, Jonathan was busy fighting the Philistines while Saul and the rest of his men were starting just to get their game faces on. Well, that evening, it was discovered by Saul that someone had broken his vow about eating anything that day. And Saul then vowed that whoever had broken that vow would be put to death, even if it was his own son, Jonathan. Oh, well, then it was discovered that it was indeed his son, Jonathan, who had broken the vow. Verse 43 of that chapter, it says this. Verse 43, "Then Saul said to Jonathan, 'Tell me what you have done.' So Jonathan told him, 'I tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now I must die.' Saul said, 'May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan.' But the men said to Saul, 'Should Jonathan die, he who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Never. As surely as the Lord lives, not a hair on his head will fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help.' So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death." You see, while Jonathan had been fighting that day and chasing the Philistines, he had discovered some honey oozing out of a beehive, and he had scooped some of that up and eaten it, and it had revived him, given him a boost of energy. But it had inadvertently broken this vow that his father had made. So he orders that Jonathan be killed, but the rest of the men say, "Oh no, we're not killing Jonathan. If it wasn't for Jonathan, we wouldn't have had this victory today." And so Saul himself suffered a humiliating defeat by his own men, by them refusing to carry out his order to kill Jonathan. Saul's foolish vow stands as an example of the general foolishness of religious legalism and vows and promises made to prove one's devotion to God. People are drawn to putting strict requirements of various kinds on themselves in an effort to prove their devotion to God. "I'm going to get up at 4 o'clock every morning and spend an hour of prayer about this thing that I want God to do. And I believe if I do that, then God will, you know, do what I want him to do. I'm going to not eat ice cream for the next year to make my body an acceptable temple of the Holy Spirit." I mean, I don't know what kind of vow you are making to the Lord and for what purposes. But I want to tell you to be very careful about making vows and promises and putting special restrictions on yourself. See, although these things have the appearance of being an expression of devotion, in reality, they're often an attempt to manipulate and control God. If I do this, then God will be obligated to do that. But it doesn't work that way with the Lord. God can't be controlled or manipulated by us. And he wants us to live by faith, trusting him, loving him, obeying him, following his leading. Vows don't produce peace and joy in our life. Instead, they often bring pressure, guilt, a sense of failure. I encourage you to not make vows and promises and add strict requirements upon yourself to prove your devotion to the Lord. Instead, just do what the Lord says and then love him. Just keep it simple. Don't do all that stuff. Well, the next story we're going to look at begins in the first verse of 1 Samuel 15. It says here, Samuel said to Saul, "I'm the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. So listen now to the message from the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty says. I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. Now go, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy all that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys." The Lord's command to Saul, given to him through the prophet and priest Samuel, is to wipe out the Amalekites. The first thing he does, though, is he reminds Saul that he was chosen by God to be king, and that his primary responsibility as king is to the Lord, not to the will of the people, not to personal gain. The king of Israel is to be God's servant first and foremost. When the king fails to fulfill this duty, he is failing to fulfill the will of God and his purpose as king. But Saul is told to totally destroy everything of the Amalekites, all people, all animals, all possessions. Now, in our modern culture, it's hard for us to imagine that such an act would be justified under any circumstances. Right? I mean, we read this and we think, whoa, did I just read that right? What did the Amalekites do to deserve this? We're told in this text that the reason for wiping them out is because what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt, referring to when Moses led the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt across the wilderness toward the promised land. The actual story is told in Exodus 17. We're given a description of the main offense committed against Israel in Deuteronomy 25, verse 17 through 19. It says, "Remember what the Amalekites did to you along the way when you came out of Egypt. When you were weary and worn out, they met you on your journey and cut off all who were lagging behind. They had no fear of God. When the Lord your God gives you rest from all the enemies around you in the land he is giving you to possess as an inheritance, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget." We're not given particulars, but it was a cold-blooded, heartless, wicked, inhuman thing that the Amalekites had done to Israel. They viciously attacked them when they were extremely vulnerable, showing no mercy or compassion of any kind, killing the weakest among them. Now, some may feel that the punishment of these people is extreme, and we don't have time to get deep into the weeds on this topic today. Please allow me to simply say that these people deserve what they're getting. The Lord is just and fair, and his judgments can be trusted. And within this context, we simply need to trust the Lord in this, knowing his character, knowing him. This war that Saul is to carry out against the Amalekites is different from all of the other wars and battles that Saul has been engaged in. It's not an act of aggression or self-defense. It's not a war to expand Israel's territory. It's what is referred to as a holy war. It's a special act to be carried out at God's command for a very special purpose of God. All of the spoils of this war are to be dedicated to God. The army of Israel is to not benefit in any way materially from this war. It's similar to the time that Joshua led the Israelite army in holy war against the cities of Jericho and Ai years earlier when they first took possession of the promised land. It was vitally important that this war be carried out exactly the way the Lord directed that it be done because of the kind of war it was. Saul and Israelite army would be acting as God's agents, his army of punishment, his arm of punishment against the Amalekites. Well, Saul, he immediately musters a huge army, marches to the city of Amalek to carry out the mission of God. And everything is looking good at this point. Saul appears to be responsive to the Lord's command and doing it just the way he's supposed to. And then we begin in verse 7. It says, "Then Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way to Havilah to Shur, near the eastern border of Egypt. He took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and cattle, the fat calves and lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed." Saul carries out God's judgment against the Amalekites, but he does not do it the way the Lord told him to do it. Saul was supposed to totally destroy everyone and everything. But Saul keeps the best of the livestock, and he doesn't put to death the king of Amalek, Agag. It says, "These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed." Saul makes his own judgment about who and what is worthy to live or not. This is not what the Lord had told him to do. Saul was supposed to follow the Lord's instructions exactly. There was no room for personal expression in how he was to do this special task. It was a grievous, disturbing thing that he had been tasked with doing. Because of the nature of it and the reasons for doing it, it was vital that it be done exactly the way the Lord told him to do it. Because no one was to get any personal satisfaction or benefit from this. It was a holy act done for a holy purpose and solely so. Any deviation from the Lord's instructions would introduce human sin into this and taint the whole thing. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel. "I regret that I have made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions." Samuel was angry and he cried out to the Lord all that night. The Lord said he was grieved, he regretted, he was sorry, he was deeply grieved, filled with pain, sorry that he had made Saul king. Samuel, too, was angry, troubled, greatly distressed, filled with agony over what Saul has done. It says that he spent the whole night crying out to the Lord about this thing. Now, some want to get themselves all tied up in mental knots over whether the sovereign, all-knowing, all-powerful God can even have regret over something he's done, since he knows all things even before they happen. First, the nature of the physical universe is still a mystery to the brightest human minds alive. It should be no surprise, then, that we have trouble understanding things in the realm of God. But second, please don't reduce what the Lord is saying here to a set of theological bullet points. If you do, you will miss the point of what is being said here. What is being described here is the broken heart of the Lord over Saul's disobedience, his self-will, his pride, his refusal to trust the Lord, his absence of love for the Lord, the pain that he's causing the Lord's people through his poor leadership choices and decisions. So verse 12 says, early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul, but he was told, Saul has gone to Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honor, has turned and gone on down to Gilgal. Saul has set up a monument in his own honor. Well, what is Saul doing? Who has he become? It's important that we remember that the destruction of the Amalekites was supposed to be an act on behalf of the Lord and under his direct sole authority and instruction. It was a holy mission that Saul and his army were on. Honor was to be given to no one except the Lord. This was not Saul's war. This was not Saul's victory. This was not an accomplishment by Saul. Saul was merely an agent of the Lord in this thing. What Saul does here reveals that he's no longer just out of step with the Lord. He's not even on the same page anymore. He's totally out of touch. He's put himself in God's place. He's turned this whole thing around to be something other than what it was intended to be. Verse 13. When Samuel reached him, Saul said, "The Lord bless you. I've carried out the Lord's instructions." But Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of sheep in my ears? What is this lowing of cattle that I hear?" Saul answered, "Oh, the soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God. But we totally destroyed the rest." Saul, when he sees Samuel, he immediately begins bragging about his obedience to the Lord's command. And that is seldom a good sign. He says, "The soldiers brought these animals." So he's shifting the responsibility, the blame over to his men, rather instead of himself. Verse 16, "Enough," Samuel said to Saul. "Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night." "Oh, tell me," Saul replied. Can you feel the emotion in Samuel's voice, the frustration, the heart that's broken here, the pain? Samuel has been wrestling all night before the Lord. His heart has been broken like it has never been before. And now Saul comes up to him with all of this patronizing baloney about how he and his men have done all that the Lord commanded. Not only that, but they have improved on the original plan by keeping back the best of the livestock to offer as a sacrifice to the Lord. Saving Agag, keeping him alive to, who knows, put him on trial? Who knows what his intent was. At this point, Samuel speaks with all of the authority and power of his prophetic office behind it. Just stop! Enough! Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. Samuel said, verse 17, "Although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission, saying, 'Go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites, wage war against them until you have wiped them out.' Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord?" Samuel reminds Saul that it was the Lord who had chosen him when he was a nobody and made him king. Saul has no place to brag about his accomplishments. He owes everything he is to the Lord. And is that not true for each of us too? I mean, every good thing in our life is a gift from the Lord. He has made each of us what we are. Whatever awesomeness you and I think we possess, it was given to us by the Lord. It's interesting. Samuel says, "You pounced on the plunder." It suggests that the motive of Saul and his men for keeping the best of the flocks may not have been as noble as Saul claimed. Verse 20, "But I did obey the Lord," Saul said. "I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king. The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal." Saul, he maintains his innocence. He claims that he has done exactly as he was told to do and more. He's captured Agag and brought him back. He saved the best livestock and brought them back. I mean, what could I have done better? I rocked this assignment. Samuel, why are you being such a buzzkill? Because you didn't do what you were told, Saul. You didn't do what you were told to do. Samuel replied, "Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king." To obey is better than sacrifice. Ritual and religious observations can't and don't take the place of obedience to the Lord. And this is as much true for us as it was for Saul. The Lord wants us to do what he says, more than engage in religious stuff. When we disobey the Lord and choose to do something else, to follow our own plan rather than his, we're putting ourselves in God's place in our life. This is one of the points that Samuel makes here. We're putting ourselves in a place of higher authority than God in our life. That's why Samuel says rebellion is like the sin of divination and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Have you ever seen your own disobedience as a form of idolatry? Elevating yourself to the place of God in your life? It's a confronting thought, isn't it? To consider that. That our disobedience carries such significance in how we see ourselves in relationship to the Lord. Who's the boss of me? I'm the boss of me. You're not the boss of me. I'm the boss of me. Saul has rejected the Lord as his king. And now the Lord has rejected Saul as king over the Lord's people. Then Saul said to Samuel, "I've sinned. I violated the Lord's command and your instructions. I was afraid of the men, and so I gave in to them. Now I beg you, forgive my sin and come back with me so that I may worship the Lord." But Samuel said to him, "I will not go back with you. You've rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you as king over Israel." See, Saul's confession, it finally comes at this point, but it lacks the needed gravity. He's too quick to just want to sweep it all under the rug and just move on. This is a huge thing. Saul is failing to see that. His failure to see the importance of the original mission was his undoing. And this same lack of appreciation for the things of the Lord, even now, question, weaken his supposed confession and request for forgiveness. And so we get the downbeat by Samuel. He won't go back with Saul. And he repeats, "Because you rejected the word of the Lord, he's rejected you as king." He basically says, "Don't you get it, Saul? It's over. You are done. You're done. As king." And Samuel turned to leave. Saul caught hold of the hem of his robe, and it tore. Uh-oh. Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. He who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind, for he's not a human being that he should change his mind." Try to picture the tension in this moment. The weight of the judgment against Saul is starting to finally sink into his thick head. He becomes desperate, frantic. He doesn't want Samuel to leave him. He doesn't want to be humiliated before the people. He sees Samuel as the only thing standing between himself and this holy God that he's offended. "Please, I beg you, Samuel, don't go. Don't leave me. I need you." Saul reaches out and he takes hold of Samuel to stop him from leaving. And as Samuel pulls away, his robe tears. Then there's that long, heavy silence between these two men. And then Samuel says, "Just like that, the Lord has also torn the kingdom from you and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you, Saul. He who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind, for he's not a human being that he should change his mind." Again, some have tied themselves in mental knots over verse 29 and the apparent contradiction that exists between it and God changing his mind about Saul being king. Some people, they reduce God to little more than a machine, what they're wooden understanding. See, God doesn't neatly fit into the model that you've constructed for him. Are you surprised? You shouldn't be. There's indeed an apparent contradiction in God changing his mind about Saul being king, and this verse saying that God doesn't change his mind about things. First, Samuel's primary intent here is not to teach theology, but to drive home the point to Saul that it's over for Saul. No amount of sorries, Saul, are going to change this. You're done. Second, the sovereignty of God, it's large enough, you guys, to account for and to respond to any and all conditions that may arise from the limited freedom that he has given to human beings and still fulfill his ultimate plan and will perfectly. God's absolutely sovereign over all of his creation. There's no question that he's ultimately in charge and in control of all things. But he's chosen to give us freedom to express genuine love and worship toward him. Our freedom is not absolute, it's limited, but it's large enough that real love can be expressed and moral accountability can be expected from us. Verse 30, Saul replied, "I've sinned, but please honor me before the elders of my people and before Israel. Come back with me so that I may worship the Lord your God." So Samuel went back with Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. Sadly, after all that's happened, Saul, he's still concerned here about his reputation before the people. He has become consumed with himself. Then Samuel said, "Bring me Agag, king of the Amalekites." Agag came to him in chains, and he thought, "Surely the bitterness of death is past." But Samuel said, "As your sword has made women childless, so will your mother be childless among women. And Samuel put Agag to death before the Lord at Gilgal. So Samuel does what Saul had failed to do. And then Samuel left for Ramah. But Saul went up to his home in Gibeah of Saul. Until the day Samuel died, he did not go see Saul again, though Samuel mourned for him. And the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel.